Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're hearing stories of summer, including one about a community baseball league told by award-winning storyteller Adam Booth.
As the ball hit the bat, I opened my eyes because there was a great crack of thunder. Lightning came down and touched the gymnasium on the back of the junior high school. Light filled the entire stadium. The ball bat split in half. The top part twirling around this way, splinters went everywhere. The ball disappeared.
And we'll also hear the next installment of The Struggle to Stay.
Just because we're young does not mean that we are any worse off. That we are any less talented.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The hot summer months usually mean getting outdoors to play or watch sports like baseball and spending extra time with family and friends. So to mark the warmer months, today's show includes stories with a summertime feel. But first, we start the show with our next installment of our ongoing series, The Struggle to Stay. Last week, we met Kira Soledal, a 20-year-old aspiring theater director and playwright who lives in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. We followed Kira for about a year.
And this place is so beautiful. How would you ever want to leave it? And I hope that I'm not the only one that sees that. I hope that I'm not the only one that sees that there's something really incredible happening here.
Kira hopes to make it here as a young artist, having started a small theater company called Whiskey Shine and Pantomime Productions with the goal to get the company licensed. The success or failure of the group plays a pivotal role in whether Kira stays or leaves Appalachia. And just to remind our listeners, Kira identifies as gender fluid, so throughout Kira's struggle to stay, we'll be referring to Kira with they, them, and their pronouns. We left off last time during auditions for Kira's production of William Shakespeare's Hamlet. Reporter Liz McCormick takes us back there.
Which one do you say first?
I would do the Act 2, Scene 2 one.
Act 2, Scene 2.
It's a late summer night in August 2016. I'm in the basement of Kira's parents' house, where the last auditions for Hamlet are taking place. Hamlet will be Kira's third and biggest play since forming WSP Productions in 2014. It's also the first time Kira's held auditions for a show.
This is it's Act 2, Scene 2, so it's your it's the probably the scene right after that.
That's Ben Johnson, Kira's boyfriend, who ends up being cast as the starring role in Hamlet.
You see yonder cloud that's almost in the shape of a camel.
By the mass, and 'tis like a camel indeed.
Methinks it is like a weasel.
It is back like a weasel.
After almost 2 hours, auditions are over. Kira and best friend and stage manager Lydia Johnson are feeling pretty good with the turnout.
People came out and took it seriously.
They took it seriously. They've been really respectful. They showed up on time.
Right, and you know, filled out their
which,
paperwork.
Which, like, not being part of a company that's recognized and working with actors is kind of like herding cats. So the fact that everybody actually showed up and it wasn't like two people showed up and then 10 people said, oh, hey, but could you do it some other day? Because I can totally make it out. But like next week?
Kira was pretty nervous before auditions started, but they were also excited. Kira says hosting auditions really made it feel like WSP was beginning to go somewhere.
Everyone took to direction really well, and everyone that auditioned was older than I am. Not that that really matters, but that is something in my mind, that I am one of the youngest people participating in the show, and I'm the one running it. And everyone just treated me and the rest of our crew behind here listening in on auditions with absolute, complete and utter respect. And that's so great, and I had so much fun. I'm so excited to do this show. I'm so excited to work with these people.
Whiskey Shine and Pantomime Productions was formed not just by Kira alone, but with the help from two people. Ben and Lydia Johnson played a major part in forming the company 3 years ago, and Kira refers to the two of them as their tribe. But more than just a hobby between friends, WSP developed into a conduit for Kira's artistic expression.
It's nice that we can make it sound all nice and professional with WSP Productions. We have stickers, we have t-shirts now. It feels like we're so real already. I'm so pleased about it. But what was once a joke is now just becoming kind of a dream come true.
Kira is determined to stay in West Virginia and make WSP a lucrative business in their childhood home. But at the same time, Kira is also terrified of feeling trapped.
As long as I can leave, I want to stay. But that's the common misconception about West Virginia, is that you live here and you get stuck here.
So one way Kira deals with that fear is through traveling.
Because it's proof to myself that I can always leave, that I can always choose something else. That, to me, is ultimate freedom.
Travel, like with art, is something Kira says they need. But to travel, you need cash. To get cash, you need work. And financial security is also something on Kira's mind. Kira gets some support from family, like using the basement at their parents' house for rehearsal space. But despite that, Kira says their family isn't able to financially support them. In fact, Kira says their family has some financial struggles of their own, and Kira often helps out. So between Kira's own bills, their family's difficulties, and keeping WSP afloat, Kira's budget is pretty tight. During the entire production of Hamlet, Kira works four jobs: as a raft guide, selling cheese on a goat farm, as a barista and manager for a coffee shop, and as a freelance photographer and filmmaker. But even with all those jobs, Kira says they only take home about $16,000 a year.
Because of the lack of opportunity here, It worries me. Because when is that going to be me? When am I no longer going to be able to afford to leave? You know, if I can't leave, then why am I staying?
So Kira's really hoping Hamlet will bring in more money while also helping to get WSP on the map. A few weeks later, Hamlet rehearsals are in full swing. One early morning, after a full night of rehearsing, Kira recorded an update on their iPhone on how things were going. It was around 1 a.m.
I just had an argument with one of my actors, and it was fine. It was totally fine. We hugged it out, and it was okay, but I'll get off of my day job, and all of these people want me to make these decisions, and it's my own damn fault. I am the one to make these decisions. I signed up for that, but half the time I just feel like, oh my god, I don't even know what I'm doing. I don't even know what I'm doing.
Kira recorded this late night update while sitting on the back patio of their parents' house. It was early fall, September, but you can still hear the cicadas.
I want to prove everyone wrong. Everyone says that it's impossible. I've had so many conversations with business owners, and it always just ends in them saying it involves so much sacrifice, and I know that. I know it does. I feel it every day. I spend hours just making our social media look pretty, and I spend hundreds of dollars trying to help get the word out, and I spend so many nights that I don't sleep just so I can come up with a plan. I know it's so hard, and I can't imagine it would be any harder than what we're already doing, which is just getting people to believe it. Getting people to believe that we are real, and that we are here, and we mean business, and just because we're young does not mean that we are any worse off. That we are any less talented.
Opening night of Hamlet is just around the corner. But will the outcome be everything Kira hoped for? And what about Kira's family, who have financial burdens of their own? How will that impact Kira's struggle to stay? More on that next time. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
You can listen to the next episode of Kira's Struggle to Stay in 2 weeks, right here on Inside Appalachia. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, two stories with an Appalachian summertime flavor. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
At one time, nothing sounded like summer quite like a crack of a baseball bat. In this part of the show, storyteller Adam Booth talks about the great American pastime of baseball and the special relationship he shared with his number one fan in this story called Cracker Jack.
This next story starts with one of my favorite American folk songs, and I'm going to sing it for you, and I hope that you will sing it along with me if you recognize it. It goes like this. Take me out to the ball game, take me out to the crowd. Oh, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back, for it's root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. Rubik here, for it's
1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out.
At the old ball game, I am easily the worst baseball player that ever lived. All you have to do is take a look at my body and see. I'm far too ectomorphic to be a good baseball player. Tall, thin, slinky. And when I was a little boy, I was short, thin, and slinky. And this was always a bit of a disgrace in my family, because the best baseball player that I ever knew was Pawpaw. Pawpaw was my great-grandfather, my mom's mom's dad. Pawpaw had grown up in Cincinnati, Ohio, or as he said, Cincinnati. And when Pawpaw was a little boy, he lived in a little Jewish community along a newly bricked street. His neighborhood was right across the back of the outfield where the Cincinnati Reds played. And back then, they didn't have those gigantic baseball stadiums. There wasn't a big set of bleachers in the back or a big wall to block those long flying hits. There was just a chain link fence. So when he was a little boy, he and his other friends could run across that newly bricked street, press their faces up against the chain link fence, and watch every baseball game that the Reds played. He watched all the greats from the golden era of the Cincinnati Reds baseball team. And after the games were over, he and his friends would play stickball right there on the street, trying out everything that they had watched the pros do. And as he grew up, he got better and better at baseball. And there was always a rumor story in my family that Papa might have gone to spring training with the Reds one year. But several generations later, when I came around, it was one of the stories that people didn't talk about anymore. But when Papa became an adult, he moved away from Cincinnati to Huntington, West Virginia. He started a furniture business. He met my great-grandmother. They got married and started a family. And he brought with him his love for baseball. And he started to coach at League 3, my neighborhood Little League baseball field. League 3 is situated on the northern half of an entire city block back home. The southern half is the home to Kamak Elementary and Junior High School. The other part was that baseball field. The diamond opened up towards the back wall of the junior high school. There was a chain link fence around the baseball diamond, and right behind home plate, there was a caboose, a real caboose. I grew up in a railroading town And the railroad company gave every Little League field a retired caboose to use as a ticket booth and a concession stand. So right behind home plate, that's where the caboose was. And when I was a little boy, I could walk the 6 blocks it took down 9th Avenue. 3 blocks down, that's where League 3 was. It was nicknamed David Glick Field, after the winningest coach in League 3 history, David Glick. I'd walk 3 more blocks, and that's where Pawpaw lived. I'd ring the bell on the front door, and when he would open up and peer over the screen door, he'd open it just that wide and say, "Come here, kiddo." I'd come in, and he'd lead me back to the kitchen, set me down in that built-in dinette set that they had with the Formica tabletop. I would stare at the mustard and turquoise-collared boomerang pattern on top of it, thinking that they must be rich, because they had something like a restaurant in their house. And Papa would shuffle over to the fridge, and he would reach up and get a box of Cracker Jacks. That's where he kept it, and he'd say, "Come on, kiddo." And we would walk the 3 blocks back to David Glick Field. We'd get our tickets on the front side of the caboose. We'd go through that little gate that went through the chain-link fence, and there was the visitor's side. Thick wooden bleachers painted sky blue every season. We'd walk right past it, past the concession stand, sit on the home side. Thick wooden bleachers painted sky blue every year. We'd sit there, and this is where for decades Pawpaw had been coaching Little League 3. Not as an official coach, just as someone from the crowd. We would sit there, he'd peel the top of the Cracker Jacks back, and I'd start eating that candy-coated popcorn, and he'd be calling out, "You're blind, ump!" He would call to the kids, "Run, hustle, run!" Things like that, and I'd be eating down, and every now and then I'd get a peanut. "Look, Papa, a peanut!" And he would scratch my head with his fist and say, "You're 1 in a million, kiddo. 1 in a million. And he'd go back to coaching, coaching, coaching. And by the end of the game, we'd made it all the way down to the bottom where that prize was wrapped in waxed paper with red and white stripes and the sailor boy and his dog. And I'd tear it open, and it would be a sticker or a little card to put in the spokes of my bicycle wheel. I'd say, "Look what I got, Papa." He'd say, "You're 1 in a million, kiddo." Rub my head. And after the game, he'd walk me the 3 blocks it took to get back home. And that's my childhood, until I turned 8. Because when you turn 8, you're old enough to play at League 3. And on my 8th birthday, who was breaking down our door? Papa. "Come on, kiddo," he said. He took me down and got me signed up. I was put on one of the local teams that was supported by a law office, Green, Ketchum, Bailey, and Tweel. We had sky blue shirts, white pants. We had practice, seemed like every single day, and I hated it. I was scrawny and tiny, and the baseball bat was about as long as I was tall. None of the helmets fit my head. They put one on, and I would just swim around in there like a bobble-headed doll. We would have practice, and we were the worst team in League 3, and I was the worst player on the worst team in League 3. It's easy to say that that season the ball hit me more than I hit it. And I would just pray anytime we had a game that we wouldn't get far enough down the batting lineup to me. But it didn't matter how poorly I played or how poorly our team played, because after the game was over, Papa was there waiting for me. He'd saved the prize from the Cracker Jacks. So "You played a heck of a game there, kiddo. You're 1 in a million. And he would walk me the 3 blocks back home. Now, at the end of the summer, just as school was about to start, I came home one day through the front door, and Mom said, "I just got off the phone with Papa. He has a surprise for you." I said, "Okay." She said, "We're going to walk down there." So we left and walked down. After 3 blocks, there was David Glick Field. 3 more blocks, there was Papa's house. Rang the bell. He came and looked over the screen door. "Come here, kiddo." Led me into the kitchen, sat me down right there at that Formica tabletop at the dinette set. He said, "You played a great season this year, kiddo. And I got you a present." He reached into the pocket of his business suit and pulled out two thin slips of cardboard, put them right there on the tabletop and slid them across, pointed with his knobby finger and said, "Those are for you." I reached out and turned them over. It was two tickets to the Cincinnati Reds. See, at the end of the summer, right before the high holidays, Pawpaw and his wife would go back to Cincinnati to buy all their kosher foods for the holiest of holidays that we celebrated. And this year he was going to take me with him. And part of the trip would be to go see this baseball team that was in my bloodline that no one would talk about. We were going to go the next weekend, and school started on Monday. And man, those were the longest days of school of my life, it seemed. Monday and Tuesday, all the way to Friday. Finally, Friday came, and I took off running away from Kamak Elementary School all the way till I got home. I threw the door open, burst through the front, and I said, "Mom, time to go. Take me down to Pawpaw's. We're going to Cincinnati." Looked around in the living room. There was Mom. She was sitting right on the floor, on the carpet. I said, "Come on, Mom, time to go down to Pawpaw's. We gotta go. Get my bag. Where is it?" And she didn't move. I noticed that she was sitting on her knees, folded right underneath of her, and she had tucked the extra fabric of her dress underneath of her. I jumped around her. "Mom, let's go." And this is when I noticed that she was crying. She opened her arms and said, "Come here, sweetie." I said, "What is it, Mom?" She waved at me, and I came over and just felt her arms wrap around me, and she began to cradle me back and forth. And she said, "I'm really sorry, sweetie. So sorry. But Pawpaw died this morning in his sleep." And at 8 years old, I wasn't old enough to understand what that meant, but I was old enough to know that I had lost my biggest fan. And from that point forward, I didn't play baseball. In fact, I didn't want to go down to League 3 at all because of the memories that I had there. And baseball left my life for about 15 years. 15 years later, I was in graduate school in Cleveland, Ohio. And I had a really nice scholarship that paid for my living and way throughout most of the year, but not during the summer. And so I had to take a summer job. And right at the end of my street, there was a little ice cream shop that had a help wanted sign. And so I went in and applied, and they said, "You're actually a little bit older than the kind of people we like to hire here. But we are opening a few stands at the Jake. Would you like to work there?" I, like everyone else who lived in Cleveland at that time, knew what the Jake was. It was the Major League Baseball Stadium, Jacobs Field. Yeah, I think I would like to work there. What an experience. So I started scooping ice cream at a Major League Baseball Stadium. And that summer, I learned what it meant when we say that baseball is the great American pastime. Families came together and they were happy. There were giveaways, bobblehead dolls, free towels. There were deals on credit cards. There were long lines to get concessions, hot dogs and corn dogs and ice cream. There was the Jumbotron. There was the seventh inning stretch. There were people singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game," and there was rooting and cheering, and it was great. And toward the end of that summer, my boss called us all together to schedule the next few home stands. Who can work this weekend? We always wanted to know who we were playing. The Cardinals, that's going to be a good matchup. Sign me up. Who can work the homestand at the beginning of next week? Who are we playing? The Blue Jays. Could be a good few games. Sign me up. Who are we playing at the end of next week? The Reds. You want to work? The Cincinnati Reds? Yeah, I want to work those games. I could finally see the baseball team that was from my family that I hadn't seen 15 years before. And just like when I was 8 years old, the next week wouldn't pass fast enough. Those days were long, long, long. Thursday night, the night before the Reds homestand started, I thought, I'll call home and tell Mom. She'll be excited for me. And when she answered the other end, I said, "Mom, I've got great news." She said, "Honey, I've got bad news. you better let me go first. I said, what is it? She said, well, baby, you know how all the schools in town are consolidating. I knew that was happening because the population in my hometown was dwindling. She said, you know how they're consolidating and they're building new schools to consolidate the old schools? Well, the only property that the school system has in our neighborhood to build the new school is where League 3 is. I knew that. I knew they were going to tear League 3 down. She said, they've pushed up the demolition date to this weekend. So we're going to have one last ball game. We're trying to call everyone to tell them to come home to see the last game at League 3. Do you think you could come home? And that was a tough decision. Go home and see the last game at my neighborhood Little League field, last game ever, or finally see the Cincinnati Reds play. I weighed it out, and I went home. It was the last chance. And that weekend, when the last game came, it almost seemed like it wasn't going to happen. Where I come from, in Appalachia, we get these tremendous thunderstorms at the end of the summer, where the sky seems real low and turns this unusual shade of brown mixed with green. And it was one of those days. But there was no thunder and no lightning and no rain, so the game was still on. And when we walked those three blocks down to League 3, David Glick Field, there was a line stretching out from behind the caboose that went three ways around the block. And it was like the greatest homecoming. People from different generations were there, people that we hadn't seen in years and years. And stories were swapped, and more stories were swapped. And we waited our turn till the line finally got around to the caboose. The woman gave us our ticket to get in. And then she said, and here's your raffle ticket. I said, raffle ticket? What for? She said, you haven't heard? We're raffling off the last chance at bat. In the very last inning of today's game. What an honor. I said, I don't want one of those. And I threw it back into the caboose. She said, come on, everyone gets one. And she put it back in my hand. I said, no, I don't want one. I gave it back to her. She said, just take it. What are the odds that it's going to be you, like one in a million? I said, don't say that. I grabbed the ticket from her, put it down in my pocket under the tissues and keys, and went in through that gate, past the chain link fence, and went past the visitor side where those thick wooden bleachers had been painted sky blue one last time. For old time's sake, I stopped at the front of the caboose and bought a box of Cracker Jacks. And then I took my seat on the home side. And the game was great. The storm held out, and those kids played their hearts out. It was Heiner's Bakery versus Dutch Miller Used Auto Sales. They played and played, and like the end of any great story, when it got to the last inning, it was tied 6-6. And the voice came over that loudspeaker, the trumpeting kind that we only ever saw there and in the gymnasium of Kamak Junior High and at the Olympic pool. It was Tenny, and it came out and said, all right, everybody, get your tickets out. And people started to get excited. They shuffled around finding their tickets. They pulled their tickets out, and the announcer said, the winning number for today's raffle is 0-0-4-4-1-1. Now, I wasn't worried because it was a 6-digit number. And I was convinced that everybody would have the first three numbers. The next number is 3-3-8. 8. And the final number is 2. I put the ticket back into my pocket. Pushed it way down to the bottom. And as the crowd grew really excited around me, looking to see who had that winning ticket, I pretended like I didn't know what was going on. I ate my Cracker Jacks all the way down until I got a peanut. Look, candy-coated peanut. Papa would have liked that.
People were starting to get mad now. Who has the ticket? Who's holding out on us? I had all the way down to that Cracker Jack's prize. I tore it open and pulled out a little plastic baseball helmet. It was crimson collared. And when I turned it around, there on the front was the insignia of the Cincinnati Reds. I knew it was a sign. From Papa. So I reached back into my pocket, I pulled the ticket out, held it up in the air and said, I've got the ticket! And people began cheering, they stood up, here he is, get him down to the field. They usher me down to the field. They put a helmet on that actually fit this time. They led me out towards home plate and they gave me a genuine Louisville Slugger made out of wood. And when I stood there at home plate, I looked out and there on the pitcher's mound was none other than David Glick himself, the winningest coach in League 3 history, there to throw out the final three pitches. And this was my destiny. So I lifted up the baseball bat, held it about where I had seen the pros hold it. Choked up high, I had learned that word from the Jake. I hit it down on the ground. I looked out at David Glick. I could see those storm clouds behind him hovering over the junior high school gymnasium. There was electricity up there in the sky. There was electricity in the bleachers behind me as the fans were on the edge of their seats. I nodded at David Glick. I had seen the pros do that. There was the windup, the pitch. It went right past me. Strike one, he called. I hadn't even seen it go by. But being a geeky child and a literate adult, I thought I would play it off like Casey at the bat. Not my style, I called out. I tightened my grip on the baseball bat. I hit it down on the ground again. I held it up and kind of went around in a circle because I had seen them do that and it looked cool. The crowd, they were getting a little bit closer. I nodded at David Glick, the windup of the pitch, it went right past me. And from over here, someone called out, good eye, which you hear all the time in little league stadiums for little kids, but not for adults. Strike two. This was it. 6-6, tied, two strikes, last inning, final pitch in the entire history of League 3. There was David Glick to throw it out. I got pretty nervous. People were chittering in the stands behind me. The storm clouds are right there. I nodded. There was the windup. And as he pitched the ball, I closed my eyes. And remembered it all in slow motion as I went back, brought the bat forward, and as the ball hit the bat, because that's how it happened, as the ball hit the bat, I opened my eyes because there was a great crack of thunder. Lightning came down and touched the gymnasium on the back of the junior high school. Light filled the entire stadium. The ball bat split in half. The top part twirling around this way, splinters went everywhere. The ball disappeared. Everyone looked around to see where the ball had gone. And then from the left field, the left fielder jumped up in the air and said, I got it. He held his glove up in the air. And then the right fielder called, no, I got it. And he jumped up in the air. And then the center fielder called out, I got it, as he jumped up in the air. Everyone looked out to the outfield and saw hail. The size of baseballs. Falling from the sky, there was another crack of thunder. Lightning lit up the sky again. And then someone said, no, there it is. And we watched as a white ball crashed through a window in the back of the gym. Everyone turned and looked at David Glick. He was nodding. Everyone turned to the ump, who was not about to disagree with the winningest coach in League 3 history, and he called it in my favor, an out-of-the-park home run. I ran to first. I ran to second. I ran to third, and when I got to home, I slid. Because I had never been there before. And as I scored the winning point, the audience jumped up, they clapped, they cheered, they ran onto the field as rain started to come down. They lifted me up on their shoulders. I was the hero. I had won. But I knew that Pawpaw had been rooting me on the whole time. And so I paid honor to him and looked up into the rain, up toward the heavens. And as I did, I saw up there in the fencing above the batter's box was stuck a baseball. I had foul tipped it straight into the air, and I was not about to tell anyone. David Glick called out, "Everybody into the gym for shelter from the storm." And the crowd, as they began to carry me off of the field, they began to sing, "Take me out to the ball game. Take, keep going." And as the crowd carried me off of the field, I thought of that little Cracker Jack's baseball cap and how it was a sign of Pawpaw, who had been rooting me on to win the game. What were the odds of that happening? One in a million. At the old ball game.
Well, that's our Summertime Stories show. We hope you're having a great summer full of warm moments and lasting memories. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. The fiddle music you heard in today's show is from the archived field recordings at the Augusta Heritage Center, recorded in the 1990s by Jerry Milnes. Our Struggle to Stay music is provided by Marisa Anderson. Roxy Todd is our co-producer. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. And Suzanne Higgins edited our show this week. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia. And the Inside Appalachia podcast is available at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.